Organized labor is having a moment. Medicine has not been immune. In recent months, 75,000 Kaiser healthcare workers went on strike, and that was just one of 26 healthcare worker strikes in 2023. One of the biggest changes for medicine, though, is a significant uptick in the unionization of trainees. As of December 2023, the Committee of Internes and Residents, or CIR, the largest U.S. union for house staff, represented 31,000 trainees, almost double what it was just 4 years ago. But trainee unionization has been controversial. Some medical educators fear that it detracts from the nobility of the profession or drives a wedge between trainees and educators. Trainees often feel voiceless and undervalued, but also scared that a pro-union stance will hurt their career prospects. Meanwhile, trainees who don't support unions may fear being ostracized by their peers. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. So why do trainees feel the need to unionize? What can unions do for their members, and what can't they do? And why have these questions become so hard to discuss? To try to answer these questions, I first spoke with two trainees with different views on unionization. Philip Sossenheimer is a palliative care fellow at Stanford, where he led trainee unionization efforts. David Bernstein is an orthopedic surgery resident at Harvard's Combined Orthopedic Surgery Program. It's part of Mass General Brigham, or MGB. During MGB's unionization campaign, David wrote an article for Stat News advocating for pausing the campaign. I should add that I am an employee of MGB, and I also did my residency at Massachusetts General Hospital. Trainees at both Stanford and MGB have since voted to unionize. I started by asking Philip why unionization is happening now, and what are the problems driving trainees to unionize?
You know, I think everybody that I talk to agrees that there's a problem with medical training. Even people who are opposed to unionization as the solution recognize that burnout is high among medical residents. Medical residents feel overworked. We feel underpaid. We feel that we're not receiving the value for the work that we're putting into the institutions and the huge sacrifices that we make to get to the places that we are. And my worry is that it's keeping people away from medicine, and that we're starting to see a shift nationally where our profession is losing ground. And it's starting from the bottom with trainees.
So what do you think is driving the burnout among trainees? And can unions help?
I think that people feel disengaged. They feel like they don't have, you know, control over their work, right? I remember during the pandemic, many of us getting jeopardized to COVID wards, and that trend continues. I think a lot of folks feel like they're basically a warm body with an NPI and that they can be slotted in like any other person can be slotted into this equation to solve the staffing needs of the hospital. We have very little control over our working conditions. And that's an area where a union could potentially help. People are also burnt out because they have low wages and they're, you know, in the community trying to pay rent, trying to afford childcare, and they're having trouble making ends meet. And that's another area where unions can help. People are burnt out because they look at the landscape of American healthcare and they see patients who are uninsured, patients who have to go home and not be able to afford the medications that they prescribe. They have to fight with insurance companies. And I'll be honest and say that's not an issue that a resident and fellows union can solve single-handedly, right? Those are bigger issues. What does excite me about the movement that's building, however, is that collective action among physicians could potentially address those solutions. And having a large body of residents and fellows who are organized under the same organization, you know, almost a third of residents and fellows now are unionized with CIR. Now we're talking about the potential for larger scale change and for, you know, conversations to actually happen with the ACGME on a larger scale. My individual house staff union at Stanford Hospital can't address the, you know, the structural issues that exist with the ACGME and the match process, nor can we address the structural issues that exist with American healthcare. So one union alone can't solve this problem, but it doesn't need to, right? If my union can get me better pay, if it can get me better vacation, if it can get me slightly better benefits, that's going to go some amount of way to solving my issues. It's certainly going to make my day-to-day life better. And if we can build a movement that incorporates not just, you know, a third of house staff, but imagine if 50% of house staff were organized under the same group. Imagine if something like that existed among attending physicians nationally, right? We have the opportunity to build a professional movement here that could address these changes.
And David, what are some of your concerns?
Ultimately, the power of a union, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, is the ability to walk away and to strike for something that we believe in, for something that we really want to make a difference. And when we saw that happen in the UK, for example, thousands and thousands of patients had their appointments and surgeries delayed, up to 350,000 patients. A lot of this comes with predicted consequences and not predicted consequences. A lot of what we have to think about, I think, in a more granular way is what are we after at its core? Because that was at the core of a lot of the MGB issues that I had a challenge with. I wanted to know what did residents want? If it was a seat at the table, that was perfectly fine with me. You can't walk in and say, we want better working conditions. Because the answer you're going to get is, what does that mean?
Yeah, I appreciate that perspective, David. And like I have told everybody who I've ever worked with, you know, unions are not going to be the only solution to the problem of American healthcare, nor are they going to be the only solution to your burnout. What I can say, and the only thing that I promise people, is that I will stand with you to try to advocate on your behalf. That's the only thing that we can do. And that's what unions are, right? A union is just the name that we have for federally protected collective action in the workplace. My question is, you know, what's the alternative, right? We have right here a structure that's been tested, that's been used in other workforces, that's been shown in well-studied economic literature to have a positive impact on working conditions. And we can be very specific about what we mean with working conditions, which we are as we're bargaining, right? It means better parental leave. It means lactation accommodations for women. It means getting the vaccine, you know, the COVID vaccine, which was the first collective action that we took as a union, basically, at Stanford. And so I don't think it's the case, at least in my experience at Stanford, that we're promising pie-in-the-sky dreams, right? And as to the point of how the union is going to accomplish these goals and the threat of strike, right? Strikes are a last resort. And just like we have the ability to negotiate without walking out of the workplace, you know, there are many steps that we can take before striking. We have engaged our political allies to pressure the CEO at Stanford Hospital to try to work with us. We write op-eds in the Stanford Daily. We write pieces, you know, that have been published in JAMA. We try to pressure people in the public. There are many ways that you can leverage your group solidarity without needing to go on strike. And, you know, if what you're saying is the only way that we can affect positive change within the workplace is through a strike, then the union would be the only way to go, because the implication would be that there's no other effective means of advocacy, which just isn't true. If you look at the literature on strikes within healthcare, it's not even clear that there is an increase in morbidity or mortality for patients during that time. What we're talking about are theoretical patient harms over the real harms that we know are happening to resident and fellows daily, and the burnout that we know affects the quality of the patient care that we deliver.
Again, I think that we should be doing something to accomplish something exactly as you had mentioned that benefits us and our patients. How that comes about, I think, can come about in a number of ways. And so when MGB offered substantial raises that made us the highest paid residents in the country, when they offered retirement benefits, when we had unlimited fertility benefits, and a whole host of kind of different improvements in our salary and our benefits, that didn't seem to be enough. Because in my opinion, having a seat at the table is important, but really having what I need to be the best physician I can be, to deliver the best care possible to my patients, to learn what I need to learn in order to operate safely and well, that's what I really care about. Not necessarily for a limited short period of time, having a seat at the table.
When David argued in his Stat News op-ed that the MGB unionization effort be paused, he knew he was going to hear opposition, which he warned his physician wife about prior to publication.
And it's funny because those comments and those discussions with my wife still ring true, because I still continue to get threats on social media or via email or telling me that I must be one of the worst doctors that will ever exist. Things that I think are not inherent to to why people want to unionize to begin with.
Okay, so Philip, what was your experience like during the Stanford unionization campaign?
You know, during our negotiations with Stanford, they were pretty clear at the bargaining table that they could afford to pay us more. They were explicit about it, you know? And the reason that they give for not wanting to pay us more is because we receive tuition-free education. Are we learning in residency? Absolutely. But we've conceived of a model in our graduate medical education that, for whatever reason, needing to learn something or being a learner means that you should not be paid a living wage or that you should not be reimbursed for the value that you generate for the hospital.
In addition to worrying about strikes, I also heard some people express concern that unions could negatively impact trainee education. So I asked Philip and David what they thought about this concern. David Bernstein.
As someone who's going to do surgery on people, I want to operate as much as possible in order to learn the skills to take on the responsibility of being in the operating room and providing care in that manner. And I think that's a real concern that can have that needs a discussion, because I don't think that there's going to be a simple answer to that problem. A lot of the benefits or proposed benefits of a union don't tackle the underlying medical education concerns and the pipeline to have enough people in order to deliver the care that we need.
These discussions are happening. You know, I spend at least 10 hours a week on union negotiations, and a huge chunk of that is on our internal caucuses where we're having these debates. We're surveying our residents. What should we bargain for? What matters to you guys? And what we heard from our surgeons was, listen, work hours, don't touch them, because we need to get our cases. And so we're not touching them. And in fact, there hasn't been a single CIR negotiated contract at a hospital that has surgeons that reduces the work hour.
This topic has been extremely difficult to talk about. And I want to understand from the two of you why you think that is.
In my experience talking to other trainees, people are afraid for repercussions for their careers. People are worried that if they speak out in favor of unionization, that they're going to be passed over for job opportunities. This is something that I worry about. You know, if you Google my name, you're going to see that I'm a union advocate. And so when I'm applying for jobs, I worry that HR is going to look at that and say, listen, we don't want this guy here.
I think it's partly what Philip mentioned and partly the era, unfortunately, we live in. We're in a moment in history where if you disagree with me, it's not viewed as you disagree with me. It's viewed as you're the other, that you're this kind of evil person who may or may not have what I think is the best interest of a patient in this situation or another objective in mind. And because of that, we're opposed, and we're opposed more than just on an idea, but on our ethics and on our morals, just because we disagree on a topic.
The good versus evil nature of the union debate has been hard for those trainees really trying to understand both the risks and benefits of trainee unionization, but it's also been hard on educational leaders. In the second half of this episode, we're going to talk to Dr. Jay Vias, an immunologist and infectious disease doctor who also directed Massachusetts General Hospital's internal medicine residency program for the last 9 years. Though Jay recently decided to step down, he was still the program director during the residents' recent campaign and vote to unionize. So I started out by asking Jay about what he perceived to be the biggest changes in medical education in the last 9 years.
There were really a number of changes. The most important, I think, had to do with the compression of time on the clinical services. You know, when I trained, we just weren't as busy. The patients weren't as sick. And now as I watched and worked with my residents as they were training, these are incredibly sick patients that get admitted to the hospital. The turnover is incredible in terms of the length of stay being shortened. Therefore, there's an increased amount of churn. You know, when I trained, discharging a patient was a relatively straightforward and pretty lean process. Now, transitioning care to another facility, transitioning safe care to home, requires about as much work as it does for an admission. And I'm just focused right now on the inpatient setting, but there's equal challenges on the outpatient setting as well. So what I noticed was that we're training individuals in a very complicated medical landscape. Oftentimes where the real resources that could really make a difference are oftentimes are in short supply or simply non-existent. And resident panels differ from attending panels significantly, and many of those have those types of needs that our system is oftentimes not optimally set up to do.
So are these the factors that drove trainees to unionize?
You know, the COVID pandemic put into sharp relief, the role that residents and trainees had in the response to COVID. But I actually think if you look back, you'll see that there were seeds of discontent that were there for a longer period of time. And I think it goes back to thinking about who are our medical students and our trainees and what is the path that they've taken when they get to graduate medical education. And I'll take you back to college, where many of them have spent a significant amount of time in college trying to perfect, you know, a perfect GPA, a perfect MCAT. Many of them have taken a gap year to get requisite research experience to get into a good medical school. They will work hard in medical school, continue to do scholastic work, engage in what I will say sometimes is this process to ensure that they get into a competitive residency. And that oftentimes may require extra time and effort to be able to do that. All the meantime, paying a significant amount of tuition debt, which puts them deeper and deeper into financial holes at a time when most of their cohorts in college have started to get a job and have started to put money into retirement and have started to think about what work and outside of work balance would look like in terms of their life choices. And so they're continuing to work in those spaces, and then they come to internship. So when they come to me, they're going to now start working 80 hours a week, oftentimes taking call, caring for some of the sickest patients as we just described. And now they're looking for support, and they're looking for some sense that there is opportunities for recognition of the work that they're doing in that area. And I think, you know, historically, the grand bargain that my generation had was that there was delayed gratification. Do the hard work now, you'll get rewarded after you finish the training process. And I think one of the byproducts that evaporated after COVID was this concept of delayed gratification. I think people recognize that time is short. There is a feeling like there's a significant amount of uncertainty in the world. I'll leave that as kind of a meta feeling that's out there. And that they need to be able to spend time that feels right in the right spaces. So if they're in an educational institution or educational environment, they want to feel like that they're getting the best education. If they're working hard to take care for those patients, they don't want to be doing things that have low yield in terms of those. And so they're insisting on a number of things that I think are actually aligned with, you know, I think the way many people think now, you know, post-pandemic, in terms of the things that they would like to be able to see. But those oftentimes, from a program director point of view, we didn't have the levers of power to fix those. And I think that there was a growing realization amongst residents that program directors, even though they served as the direct supervisor of trainees in the graduate medical education space, lack the agency to make the types of meaningful changes that they were looking for, whether that be in compensation, whether that be in benefits, whether that be in restructuring the workplace to prioritize education and enhance patient safety and enhance patient experience. So I think the lever that they felt was most important to pull there was to be able to have the opportunity to have a voice at the proverbial table. And they felt, and I heard this from my own residents, that we know you know what we struggle with, but we also worry that you're not able to effectively communicate that to those that have the power to change these things. And so we want to be able to do that through unionization. And so so I don't think unionization was the first lever, but rather the ultimate lever that was pulled to try to affect these types of changes.
And so how did you respond to them when they came to you saying that we are organizing to vote to unionize?
I think to be an effective program director, you have to journey with your residents through both those good times and bad times. And that requires a bit of vulnerability on the residents and real support, I think, by the program director as well as the faculty. When I say the program director, you should always include the incredible dedicated educational faculty that support the residency program. You know, I had wanted to make sure that that relationship, which is built on trust and that has vulnerability shown by the trainees in those situations, there wasn't an opportunity for there to be kind of, at least between the program directors and the trainees, an us versus them philosophy. I think that becomes incredibly corrosive. And while I recognize and fully acknowledge that I am part of the leadership of the institution as serving as that program director, you know, I personally felt very sad that we had reached this point, because I felt like it felt like a personal failing to me that I wasn't able to advocate strongly enough for the trainees that they had to use unionization as the mechanism by which they felt that change was effective. And it wasn't a lack of effort on my part. It was a lack of being effective in that voice to be able to affect the type of change that was necessary. And, you know, so I had my own personal feelings about that. But, you know, when it came to being pro-union or anti-union, I was neither pro-union. I was not anti-union. I've always been pro-resident, and I've always been pro-residency program. I love my residents, and I love my residency program. Those things will never change. I tried as many times as I could to remind the health system as we moved forward through these processes that this isn't an us versus them, because, quite frankly, they are our future colleagues. And we need to treat them as our future colleagues. And sometimes I worried that got lost in the translation in what became a relatively bitter fight for whether the trainees would choose to unionize or not. I come from a science background, and so, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking and weighing evidence and trying to determine whether we have enough evidence to formulate whether a hypothesis is true or not. And I love that exercise, but that process, which is so familiar to me, was not really available in this discussion of unionization, simply because we just didn't have the forum by which we could have that type of open conversation.
I think it would be helpful to hear a little bit more about what happened when you attempted to have an open and honest forum to talk about the unionization process and some potential pros and cons, benefits and risks, weighing the evidence, however you want to think about it, with your house staff.
I've always had and strive to have an open and honest relationship with my residents. I felt that was the only way to lead in that way. And so early in this process, I had intended to have a noon conference to really speak about the union efforts. And again, in that meeting, I had made efforts to do it the way I frame it, the way I saw it to be important. What were the pros? What were the cons? What are the things that I worried about and the like? It was a well-attended meeting, probably the best-attended noon conference we've had all year. I think that, unfortunately, you know, what was a nuanced conversation got eventually framed up in ways that didn't really reflect the reality of a nuanced conversation when comments were made in social media platforms, including Reddit and Twitter, which painted a strongly different picture, you know, for those things.
Just to be clear, Jay was accused on social media, and specifically Reddit, where a lot of students go to seek information about training programs, of being a union buster.
Obviously, the result of the social media posts, you know, kind of prevented further open conversations like that, which, you know, I have to say I lamented.
This is sort of one of the root ills of our society, I think, is that I don't know if it's because of social media, I don't know if it's because we're so polarized in other ways, but the opportunities to have nuanced dialogue about complex topics are few and far between.
So people did yearn, individuals did yearn to have those types of conversations at that level. Many times I would have those individual conversations with individuals. But, you know, I worry that, you know, sometimes when we fear having those larger conversations in larger rooms, that sometimes that might be a reflection of a lack of trust and whether someone is operating off a specific agenda. I think that there were some people who worried that, you know, being a program director and serving, you know, in a leadership role by definition put me on the anti-union platform. And if people got that impression, they didn't really spend any time talking to me about it or hearing what I was saying. But I think they felt that that was largely where program directors were landing. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, I think a lot of program directors, you know, who kind of grew up in education really felt that it was very important and that they do what the health system wanted simply because they've reached the pinnacle of their career being a program director. And there's some element of, you know, I worry about my job security if I'm not really kind of pleasing the people who I report to. When I came on to serve as the Renzi program director, I was already had a full-time job being a basic science investigator in the Division of Infectious Disease. And so I always operated under having essentially two jobs. And so for me, it was very easy because I only acted how I thought what I felt was right to do and always welcomed the opportunity to go back to my lab full time should anybody be worried that I was doing the job in the wrong way. And so that gave me a level of freedom that I think most other program directors didn't have.
I knew from having spoken with Jay previously that one of the issues that became contentious at this forum were snacks for trainees. Every week, Jay filled his office with snacks so that food would be available to residents at all hours. But before we get into the fraught snack discussion, I asked Jay to explain what the snacks represented to him in the first place.
The snacks were always a means to an end, right? The opportunity to be able to spend a little bit of time with the residents. And I left my door open at night. And so people could come in and get a snack at, you know, 7 p.m. or 3 a.m. or whatever time of the night. It wasn't uncommon that I would come back to my office in the morning and I would have a sticky note on my desk and said, I've had a really bad night with some really terrible complications of some patients, and I just needed 5 minutes and just a break. And I came to your office, and I grabbed a snack, and, thank you so much. For me, those were really meaningful notes. I still have them. For me, they always represented what I thought was being able to see our residents, right, for what they do. I'm an Indian. I grew up in a very kind of a somewhat traditional Indian household. Food was a currency of love, as it is in many cultures. And so for me, the idea that you would withhold food was the equivalent of withholding love, and it just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Ultimately, I do think that, you know, there was a, even after the union vote did occur, there was a decision that was made by leadership to remove the food.
Even though the snacks for Jay were a gesture of love, my sense is that the forum he held, he ran into a shoot the messenger problem. One thing that often happens when trainees unionize at any institution is that benefits become equalized between programs. In some ways, that's good. For instance, all the trainees may get a higher salary or better benefits. But for programs that had traditionally gotten extra perks, and I can say from having been an MGH medicine resident that we got a lot of perks, there's also a risk of losing things like nice lunches or 24/7 snack availability. And in the end, the snacks did get cut. But I wanted to understand from Jay why pointing out this risk before the vote to unionize wasn't well received.
During that conversation, Lisa, you know, I raised what I thought were some of the potentials that might happen should unionization come to pass. And one of those things I did mention was that there would be limitations on those things. And so if we were to simply divide the world of programs into the haves and the have-nots, the Department of Medicine and MGH was clearly one of the ones that had. And I worried that in this effort to kind of make everything the same, what would end that had to happen would be that, you know, things would have to be taken away. That night, I worried out loud that that was going to happen. And a specific example that I used were these snacks. I already measured and you can do the calculations, but you know, we're in excess of $50,000 a year in M&Ms and popcorn, right? And you can imagine that, that's something that's going to be ripe to be removed. And so I use that as an example, you know, in that area. And so, yes, I think people did respond to that. If people saw, you know, again, I want to say there was a small minority of individuals who may have seen the snacks, you know, mostly as a transactional thing that, you know, I just brought in snacks. But I think the point I was trying to make really was that, you know, I, as a program director, enjoyed a significant amount of autonomy. And if I thought there were important things that we needed to do to add to the residency program to enhance the resident experience, I recognized that that would likely come to a halt. And I wanted to express my concern to the residents in that meeting.
It's ironic to me that, as you said at the outset, part of what was going on before the decision to unionize was that the residents had recognized that you, JVS, don't necessarily have the agency to move every lever at the level of the institution to get them what they want, and that part of the consequence of the unionization is actually taking away even more of your autonomy to advocate for them. And I think that that's an important thing for us to recognize, again, because it's very hard to talk about whether unions have any unintended consequences, because the discourse is so fraught that they might.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things, in when you're having a conversation where you want to have a nuanced conversation, there's going to be pros and cons of everything. And I believe that medical trainees are very well versed in that concept, based on how they practice medicine every day. And so, again, I think the ability to be able to kind of see what are those trade-offs and what are those unintended consequences that come up would have benefited from a broader discussion, but it didn't take place with the faculty, or it didn't take place with faculty and resident.
I do want to ask you one more question, because it's something you said to me when we talked, which is that some of the most gifted educators don't want to get in this game anymore. And I, you know, I've heard that from a lot of educators, honestly, that for some reason, lots of reasons, complex reasons, it's become a lot harder to be an educator. In addition to like all of the hard things that come along with trying to train people. And I'm wondering what you think that's all about.
It's more than one reason, but you know, I think the you know, training, first of all, being an excellent teacher for medical students, for residents, for fellows, that's hard work. But you know, there's the increased challenges that are faced in a complicated inpatient setting. The fast pace that is required for ambulatory medicine, the increased demands to do more with less, the lack of recognition by academic medical centers on how to promote excellent educators, and then lack of how you value education in an RVU or compensation-based mechanisms, pose real challenges to how we're going to educate the next generation. And there are really important challenges here that we need to be working on. Unionization adds to some of that. And I hope that for many people who are thinking and contemplating a career in medical education, that they recognize that that is an incredible and important role. We all play an important role. I'm very interested, for a significant amount of self-interest. I anticipate that in the future years, I'm going to grow older and I'm going to need medical care, and I want to be cared for by really great physicians. And that's what I think we all as humans want to be able to do. We recognize that, you know, as much as AI sounds wonderful, at the end of the day, if someone needs to be told that they have cancer, it's not going to come from a computer. It's going to come from a human being who's going to walk and journey with that patient through the journey that is known as cancer. And we need to be able to make sure that that human experience is accompanied by people who are incredible. And to take people, you know, we still have incredible numbers of people who want to go into medicine. Look at how many people apply for medical seats in the United States. We have a number of people who want to come into this noble profession. And so we need great teachers. We have great talent in our pipeline. We need great teachers to be able to do that. And I worry that a lot of the things that I just mentioned will continue to dissuade people from a career in medical education, because I think that it is both noble, it's necessary, and it's become increasingly complicated. And so I don't have a great solution to it, but I know that there is that need, and we need to be able to make sure that we still retain the very best there.
I agree, which is why the rise of training unions has always seemed to me like a tip of the iceberg phenomenon. What bubbles up to the surface are tangible problems unions might be able to solve, like inadequate salaries and benefits. But underneath, we have so many layers of existential problems. Some, like medicine's corporatization, are coming from within the profession. But others, like evolving cultural norms around work and generational change, are coming from outside. Up next, on Not Otherwise Specified, we're going to examine some of those generational shifts and the role they're playing in our training environments.
The tensions run the gamut. Some will be that new employees are not just willing to fall in line and do what a boss tells them to do. When older generations were entering the workplace, the norm was suck it up. You know, you got to do what they tell you to do. You got to pay your dues. This generation does not necessarily see that that is the case. So sometimes they will feel like they know better. And the reality is sometimes they do know a better way to get something done because they are more adept often at using the tools of today. That can create a frustration where they do have something to contribute, but an older person is going to say, but that's not how we do it here.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'd like to thank our editor, Deborah Molina, our senior producer, Mary Rose Madden, and Blue Dot Sessions for the music. Thanks for listening. We're taking a brief pause next week, but we'll be back on March 6th. Until then.